From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer Mark Kaufman says the question of whether there is life beyond Earth has been answered. Not confirmed yet, but when you talk to the growing number of scientists who are exploring the question, he says the consensus is it's virtually impossible that there is not life elsewhere in this universe. But before you start imagining aliens with big eyes, back up and think about more basic life forms, like simple microbes. You can test the premise here on Earth. These scientists are finding life in the most extreme places. Kaufman puts it this way: life is far, far more tenacious than we ever imagined. Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about the hunt for life beyond Earth and what that might mean if there is. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, First Contact, the science writer Mark Kaufman says that for thousands of years, we humans have wondered about life beyond this planet. If it's just us in this universe, he writes, what a terrible waste of space. Well, it turns out the scientists who have been studying all of this say maybe it's not just us. There are still a lot of questions and disputes, of course, but there seems to be something of a consensus that there is, in fact, life out there. And today in the program, we're talking about it. You can learn a lot by exploring space, of course, but much of what we're coming to know about extraterrestrial life comes from what we're observing here on Earth. Mark Kaufman went deep into the gold mines of South Africa, to the mouth of a volcano, into forbidding deserts, places where you figure you wouldn't find much in the way of life. It's like that song, New York, New York, if life can make it there, maybe it really can make it anywhere. Mark Kaufman is joining us today to explain what we know in this hunt for life beyond Earth. His book is First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. He has a new book coming out called Mars Up Close, Inside the Curiosity Mission. He also writes about space for NationalGeographic.com, and he's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Mark Kaufman, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
I wanted to start... I wanted to start with the story of you. This has been a few years now. You went to this journalism boot camp at MIT, where you met a scientist named Sarah Seeger. And I guess if I understand it right, this is sort of the story that got you thinking, got you studying all of this, looking into all of this.
Yes, absolutely. Sarah is one of the kind of new generation of very articulate, very outgoing, very brilliant. I mean, she's certified brilliant now. She got one of the MacArthur Genius Awards. But she was talking to the group of us, you know, journalists who write about science, and she said that in her lifetime that she had every expectation that life beyond Earth would be discovered. And as someone who has been a journalist for a long time, although at that point had not been a science writer for all that long, all of the journalistic kind of, you know, little buzzers went off and said, wait a second, that's a great story. I mean, independent of the science of it, that's just a terrific story. And so I listened carefully to what she was saying and then got back in touch with her and then gradually began this odyssey that took me around the world several times, looking for and talking to the people who were involved in this really dynamic and very fast-growing search for life beyond Earth. Generally speaking, people, you know, the first reaction of many is, well, you know, that's pretty strange, that's pretty weird, and they think of the little green men and everything. But in fact, this is truly cutting-edge science. You have some of the best and brightest who are working on it, and the implications of what they're doing are enormous in terms of our place in the universe, but they also are enormous in terms of understanding how life began here. So there's a lot on the table.
I wanted to talk about this Of course, the method that helps us know whether there's life beyond Earth, astrobiology, is the field you write about. And you describe these people as iconoclastic, part Carl Sagan, you say in your book, part Watson and Crick, part Indiana Jones. What are the characteristics that sort of they share, do you think, these people?
It's a very interesting question. One is an awful lot of them are musicians or were musicians.
Wow.
And I'm not exactly sure the connection, but
right.
But I think that there is one. Almost all of them are people who began working on issues, be they in geology or astronomy or biochemistry or planetary science or whatever, that were really way outside of the box. They were things, for instance, Sarah Seeger, some of her early work was on trying to describe, to understand the atmospheres of planets beyond Earth, these exoplanets that were just beginning to be discovered. And at the time when she began, she tells me that her advisor and everyone else said, well, Sarah, this is really lovely, but we're never going to be able to do this in our lifetimes. And we already can. So that was the kind of characteristic of someone willing to stick their neck out. And if I could give another example, Tullis Onstott is kind of the perfect example. He's a geologist at Princeton. And some years ago, he got very interested in the question of life deep below the surface. Right. And he worked with some oil companies trying to find in their drilling whether or not they were also bringing up microbial life. And he had some success, but he just knew that it wasn't getting where he needed to go. And he had learned that the deepest holes on Earth are the South African gold mines and silver mines and diamond mines. And so he went to South Africa. He didn't have any entree. He didn't have any support. There was no National Science Foundation or NASA behind him at that point. And he kind of staked an awful lot of his professional reputation on this endeavor. Kind of fast forward 10, 15 years, he discovered worlds deep below the surface, 3-4 miles below, that totally revolutionized our understanding of how life exists on Earth and may well on other planets. So those are the kinds of people that we're talking about, people who wouldn't take no for an answer, people who thought very much outside of the box, and people who were risk takers.
Is this you say in the book that we've moved past the so-called, as you call it, the giggle factor that's associated with, you know, ET and UFOs. Is it really even all that controversial anymore? I know there are lots of disputes about the particulars, and we'll talk about some of this, but is it really even all that controversial anymore to say with some confidence there is life out there?
I would argue that no, it's not controversial. However, you have this one glaring problem, which is that none has ever been found.
Yeah.
And some say astrobiology is, the science without a subject or without a specific piece of evidence. But I think that if you were to poll people, I would imagine there would be an overwhelming sense that there is life beyond Earth, and the science is pointing to that almost unanimously. But you do have this issue of, it's never been found. Mm. There are good reasons for that. We're very early in the process, but in kind of full answer to your question, in many ways, I think it isn't controversial anymore. Although there are people who argue in books and articles that that you can't say that simply because it hasn't been found.
I wonder if it's hard to write about this in some ways, in the sense that it doesn't really involve a lot of, although there are some, a lot of these dramatic eureka kind of moments. I mean, you describe it in the book as being kind of incremental, this science, smaller clues here. And you say it's kind of like crime scene forensics. So in that sense, it must be challenging to sort of write about it in a dramatic fashion. Does that make sense?
Yes, and it has definitely been one of the challenges, although one of the things that also happens is that As one as a reporter slash author goes into this, you get deeply, deeply fascinated, and you begin to understand why one little bit of information has enormous implications. I think we'll talk a little bit later about what's going on Mars and the reports that are coming in today. But they're precisely that, where you find you put together several bits of what seems to be incremental, fairly small scientific snippets, and the people who are really deeply knowledgeable about it will put it together and say, oh my God, that means why, you know? And yes, it's sometimes difficult to find the drama, or it appears to be difficult. It feels to me that now that there is the drama, but it's up to other people to know, to determine whether or not they consider it dramatic.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about it, too, is that I guess the really dramatic way to talk about this is to, you know, if you look at these really complicated life forms, and everyone has in their mind when you talk about extraterrestrial life something, you know, it could be, you know, an alien or whatever it might be. But in order to talk, to get to that point where you're talking about more complicated forms, we've got to start with single-cell creatures. I mean, we have to sort of start at the beginning and talk about life in that context, I guess.
Yes, and again, as someone who spent a lot of his career doing things like being a foreign correspondent and who was not necessarily deeply embedded in science for a long time, this has been a remarkable education for me and a great adventure in that sense. But one of the things that perhaps many people know, but I didn't, was that for most of the time that there has been life on Earth, it was single-cell microbes. It's something like, you know, 3 out of the 4 billion years that there's been anything here, it's just been single-cell microbes. So, and in fact, most of the life on Earth now remains single-cell microbes. And so they are life in the largest way possible. And in terms of making that into a leap to into life that's intelligent, you know, that's a complicated thing. But what's also to me very fascinating is that we kind of know how evolution occurs. You know, it goes from very simple to more complex, and there are lots of add-ons and mistakes and things that happen. We don't know how life began. And science doesn't know how life began. And so that, in many ways, is the one of the really signal questions that all of this looking for extraterrestrial life brings up. How did it start? Yeah. And if it's there in any form, that's the big deal.
And what does it mean? I mean, you tell the story about a researcher named Carol Cleland at the University of Colorado. And you've talked about this, where she was at this meeting, where she essentially says it's impossible to define life. We don't know enough about life to even say what life is. And you mentioned she got quite a reaction to that.
Yes, I mean, this was a number of years ago, but because there had been a general consensus that you could describe life in terms of metabolism, in terms of replication of DNA or RNA, and what she was saying was that doesn't really cut it. It doesn't go far enough because there are a lot of other things that potentially could be considered life that don't fit those characteristics. For instance, viruses, and there are other prions and other things like that, as I did a little bit more research into it, I found that there was an author who had gone through the proposed definitions of life in the last couple decades, and they were something like 293 or something. Mm. There's a kind of a grab bag definition that NASA tends to use, but they would acknowledge that it's very limited, at the ground level, we don't know what life is. We kind of think we could, look at things and say, oh, my goodness, that's life, as some have said to me, rather like pornography. You know, exactly, it's hard to define, but you know what it is. But in terms of life, there is no – anyone who tells you that there is a definition that will take everything in is off base.
Yeah. We'll get to the particulars of this. One of the questions is, you know, did life begin here on Earth, for example, or did it arrive here, you know, via an asteroid or a comet? And I guess the answer is, in some ways, it's probably a little bit of both. But you say in the book, for example, that nobody really knows why, but pretty much all of the molecules that make up the building blocks of life as we know it have this certain quality that is otherwise not seen on Earth.
Right, the chirality, yeah. Which is kind of the handedness. And this is something that, again, is a puzzle. Science doesn't really know why this is the case. They have found in meteorites some organic material coming into Earth that has some aspects of this right-handedness or left-handedness. And they think that in that sense it was delivered, but yes, it's actually though an important part of the search for life beyond Earth, because if they find an organism on Mars, let's say, or the remains of an organism, or the biosignature of one, and they could determine what its chirality was, you know, the handedness of some of its molecules, then they could have a good idea of whether or not the two kinds of life are in fact related, as in one came from Mars and landed on Earth. Mm-hmm. And so chirality is, one, a real defining aspect of life that no one quite understands, and two, it's a possible tool for understanding a lot more about life elsewhere.
Mark Hoffman is with us. His book is First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the hunt to find life beyond Earth. It wasn't so long ago you'd be pretty quickly dismissed if you were a scientist and spent much time thinking about extraterrestrial creatures, but now it's a settled and pretty respected field. Science writer Mark Kaufman is our guest today. He says it's just a matter of time before we're going to determine that life exists elsewhere in the universe. He's with us to talk about what that life might be like, what it means, and what it tells us about life here. His book is called First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. If life, you know, the question is, did life, some life come from an asteroid or a comet or some other thing, or did it start here? And there's a big question, like, where would have life started? And you write about these, what you call extremophiles, or what are called extremophiles, these incredibly forbidding environments where we're finding life, microbial organisms. Talk about that.
Sure. This has really been a huge revolution in understanding life on Earth and potentially elsewhere. And it goes back to what I had mentioned earlier about Tullis Onstott and the microbes that he found that were 3-4 miles down. These are living life forms that never see sunlight, have absolutely nothing to do with sunlight. They live off of the radioactive decay of some of the rock nearby, and they're called chemolithotropes, and they, in effect, their food is the transfer of electrons between some compound and another, and they exist deep underground. They exist floating in the atmosphere. They exist nearby deep sea heat vents that are sometimes 350 degrees high in temperature, and they exist throughout Antarctica, deep into the glaciers of Antarctica, in the ice pack. You're going to find living organisms, And this has really widened the field for the kinds of environments where life might exist. Almost none of this was understood 20 years ago, and every time you move, you know, that people, scientists look, they find more life. And currently, one of the areas of great interest is organisms that can resist radiation, and radiation is cosmic galactic radiation and solar particle radiation breaks apart some of the bonds that are that hold life together, and yet there are organisms, bacteria, that are really, really good at resisting that. I mean, orders of magnitude, thousands of times better than anything else. And there is a view now that, well, you know, that kind of organism might have been able to thrive in a place like Mars where there is a heavy radiation pummeling. And but in any case, so that's the kind of extreme life that we're looking at, little bits of life that can resist incredible assaults.
Yeah.
And just to kind of circling back to something as well, for much of the time that single-cell organisms were all there was, their oxygen, which is a very toxic element, was not common. And if it was, most of the living matter would have died.
Right.
So it's interesting to think about what is extreme, because at one time, oxygen was extreme, and now we'd all die without it.
Yeah. Tenacious is the word you've used before in terms of life, more tenacious than we really thought. And you mentioned Tullis Onstott, and I wanted to read something you wrote about that one of the bugs, he gives it a name, I'll have you talk about that here in a moment, that he finds deep in the South African gold mine. And you say a reading of this bug, as well as an analysis of the age of the water that is often its home, you say, shows that the microbe has not seen the light of day or interacted with anything produced from sunlight for perhaps up to 40 million years. But it has DNA, you write, it reproduces, and it is clearly alive. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, and after they did some DNA analysis, they also determined that it probably had a tail.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, I had the good fortune to go down, not with Tullis, but with some others, into some of these deep mines. And, you know, you're walking through these tunnels that are way underground, and it's very hot, and it's kind of wet from both the water that's used in some of the drilling, but also there are always little fissures in the rock, and water can come through those, and that's where the bugs live. You know, deep into these rocks, sometimes there might be a little pool, or it might just be you know, in the crack itself that's coming out. And there are whole environments, and what Onstott says is that, you know, some of the things that he has found are probably just the beginning. Mm. You know, that there probably are whole ecosystems that live in total darkness, totally unrelated to surface life at all. Not to say that, you know, that there are necessarily high concentrations. It's not like you're going to be in the tropics where you're just kind of teeming with life. But there's enough to keep a community alive.
What's the name they give it again? I have a hard time pronouncing it.
I'm afraid that I don't have it in front of me.
Aurex Vader?
Aurex Vader.
Aurex Vader.
Yes, yeah, I'm sorry.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
Yes. Actually, I was just what I've been writing about recently was a different radioactive microbe, and that's the one that was in my mind. But yes, Aurex Vader, which comes from a book that talked about you know, a journey into the center of the Earth. And
yeah.
The
Jules Verne.
Aurex Vader is part of that.
I think what's... I mean, the question you mentioned that Onstott's discoveries in these gold mines found that microbes would kind of broke the rules of life in the sense that because we all figured that to survive, a creature Something that was alive needed an energy source. It needed a somewhat hospitable environment. You know, it had all these things that it needed, but this seems to have changed everything. And I guess the question is, are there no rules? Can life exist in pretty much any circumstance? Or what are the dynamics if we understand them now?
I'm sure that there are places where life can't exist. I mean, in deep space, the radiation environment might be too great. But there are certain aspects of life that are that almost everyone will agree have to be part of the definition. Yeah. There has to be some kind of energy source that comes in, gets used, and that there is a byproduct. That, you know, in other words, there's metabolism. And similarly, there is a general consensus that there has to be some kind of genetic replication, that you have to have some form of not only placing your progeny on into the future, but also to modify that through, you know, through the evolutionary process. So those are the two things that that must be there, as far as most people will argue. But the eye-opening thing is how absolutely flexible that definition becomes when you see where the replication and where the metabolism might exist. And again, that's where it gets people thinking, well, gee, you know, there are environments on the moon Europa or Enceladus, one of the moons of Saturn, or on Mars, where, you know, after initial discoveries about those extraterrestrial places, the assumption was no life could ever live there. Yeah. And that's really been changed.
How many planets do we figure this number? It seems like we're learning more and more. It's exponential, the knowledge we're getting about this. But Mark Hoffman, how many planets do we know that are out there that could have the same kinds of conditions as this planet, the planet Earth?
You're absolutely right that it's changing all the time. But most recently, one of the people most involved in this field, Jeff Marcy, wrote a paper where he was talking about basically hundreds or tens of billions of planets that are likely to be Earth-like in the solar system. And just to step back from – and I'm sorry, not the solar system, in the universe. But just to step back for a second, there are now, it is understood, hundreds of billions of stars in every galaxy, or in most galaxies, certainly in our Milky Way. And within the galaxies, with those stars, you're going to find planets circling almost all of them. And there even are planets that kind of go wander off on their own. They're not even orbiting a planet, a star. And what they're finding more and more is that these planets, or the solar systems, contain a wide variety of crazy planets that are very large and close to the star, or far away, or whatever, you know, enormous. But they're also finding ones that are somewhat Earth-like, and the technology is getting better and better so that they can find more and more of those. Mm. And they're orbiting in what's called the habitable zone, which is the distance from that particular star where water can sometimes be liquid. It's not too hot that it's always gas, and it's not too cold that it's always ice. That is, again, one of the revolutions going on here, that there's the understanding that you have billions, tens of billions of habitable zone planets in the universe. And that's the point at which you say, my goodness, I mean, how could there not be life? Especially since we also know that all of the important components of life, be it water, hydrogen, even amino acids, other carbon-based compounds, they're all out there in the stars, in the space, and they fall down on planets just like they fall down on Earth all the time, either in the form of meteors or little teeny meteors or something called interplanetary dust. And all of that material is what scientists understand, believe, is needed to make the organic compounds that make life. And they fall on Earth, and they're falling everywhere else too. Mm.
But this may be a difficult question to really get at, but I'm wondering, do scientists spend any time going beyond the sort of micro particulars of what they're looking at? And is anyone speculating or talking about the bigger questions about, for example, say, the trajectory of evolution? Like, for example, if they're imagining that there can be life elsewhere, does anyone take it a little further to say, okay, if evolution works this way, then if we speculate, it might make sense that these the very simple single-cell organisms would replicate, get more complicated, the process of natural selection get more complicated, and even have sentience at some point or consciousness at some point. Do you hear much of that among these scientists?
Absolutely, and in fact, it's really a given. I mean, it's part of their understanding. The origin, you know, the moment when life begins is the great mystery. Yeah. The evolutionary part is much less so, and so the expectation is, I mean, and it is a total, almost unanimous expectation, is that there would be planets that would be suitable for evolution to occur, where the sun would be stable for a long enough period of time, where you would have the right kind of component chemicals and minerals and so on. And so in answer to your question, yes, this is very much on the table. And the concentration on the microbial life is, to a certain extent, a stand-in for that other larger discussion. Yeah. And you do have groups like the SETI Institute,
right,
which is dedicated to trying to find technologically advanced life elsewhere in the universe. And, you know, they use they're constantly monitoring for radio waves that might be a sign of those of that life. So it does kind of go across the board from them, you know, the SETI, who was looking specifically for intelligent life, to the others who are looking for the microbial life as a signal that life can begin and then would evolve elsewhere.
Do you ever, this is maybe a silly question, but does anyone ever talk about what these life forms could look like? Like, you know, the question of whether or not it's possible that through the process of evolution, you would end up with legs and arms or, you know, working brains and, you know, does that make sense?
Sure. I'll just peel it back a little bit.
Okay.
People often ask, well, you know, isn't it possible that life on another planet would be entirely different than on Earth?
Yeah.
You know, that it would have different components, and on Earth everything is based on carbon. Carbon and water are the two essential ingredients, and they are then what then helps form that replication and process and the metabolism process. And people say, well, you know, couldn't it be silicon? Couldn't it be some methane as a fluid, as there is on the moon Titan? There are lakes of methane, and the answer that people tell me is probably not. Carbon is the element that bonds best and most easily with everything else.
Right.
And so it is the perfect kind of backbone for all living things. And similarly, that water, H2O, is the perfect solvent. Now, this doesn't rule out other possibilities. It just says that these are the ones that are most likely. So then once you have a carbon-based or a water-based world, how could that evolve?
Yeah.
And the field is really wide open.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason to think that it would that things would end up being, you know, like us or like platypuses or anything else. I mean, it really evolution can take things in all different kinds of directions, and probably would.
Yeah. As long as you had a lung to process, you know, oxygen, right? Or right? Like if you had the basic components, maybe the form may be different, but there are some basic forms that would have to exist for an organism, however it looked, to keep evolving, I suppose.
That definitely is the understanding. You'd need to have that kind of genetic material.
Yeah.
to propel on into the future, to have reproduction, and then also you would need the metabolism to keep going, to have food, to have energy, and to be able to do those kinds of things. But going back to an earlier subject we discussed, this is, we're on kind of the cutting edge of defining life, and so what I said about carbon and water is a prevailing view, but there's a counter view that also says, well, there could be weird life that's based on a lot of different other kind of compounds, and wouldn't it be awful if we were on another planet or made some other observation about an exoplanet far away and saw a signal and we were just kind of too unknowledgeable to know that that was life?
Yeah. Mark Hoffman is with us. His book is First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. When we get back from a break, we're going to talk about Mars. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with science writer Mark Kaufman. We're talking about the hunt for life beyond Earth. His book is called First Contact. Let's talk about Mars. There are a lot of controversial theories, of course, in astrobiology, but you mentioned that the most is whether we've already found extraterrestrial life from a meteorite that came from Mars.
Right. This is the famous ALH 84001 that landed in Antarctica long ago. Antarctica is the place where scientists go to look for meteorites for study, because it was understood or believed that there was very little contamination that would then go into the meteorite because there was little life. As it turns out, there probably is more than people imagine. But in any case, that's where this meteorite was found. And in the mid-90s, it became there was a very high-profile science paper and NASA press conference in which some NASA scientists said this meteorite, which we know is from Mars for using a variety of different tools, that it has five or six biosignatures that all together make it extremely likely that this once had life. It was a meteorite that was later dated to have been, created 4 billion years ago. It wasn't circling all that long, but it was on the Martian surface for a long time. Fascinating stuff. I mean, then President Clinton talked about it. There was a great deal of interest. There was also then a huge kind of backlash from other scientists saying that there were, a lot of holes in the science and in the research and in the interpretation. And I think it would be fair to say that the Mars meteorite of the mid-90s has been kind of put on the shelf. There are things about it that people still find interesting and important, but the idea that it had biosignatures, that it meant that there was life from Mars that came to Earth, is no longer largely accepted. However, what happened was, because of the huge public interest in this, the field of astrobiology just kind of blossomed. Yeah. And funds started going into it from NASA. The notion that NASA could and should be looking for life elsewhere was actually very very important early on. The Viking missions in the mid-1970s to Mars, their whole goal was to try to detect life. It was very confusing results. Kind of everyone threw up their hands afterwards. But after the Mars meteorite in the 90s, it became clear that there was this public interest. NASA kind of re-embraced astrobiology. And I think it would be accurate to say, fair to say, that the Curiosity mission now on Mars is the first real astrobiology mission since Viking. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
It is not specifically looking to detect life as Viking did, because scientists now know that we don't know well enough to do that. But it is looking for habitats, for conditions, for the kinds of chemicals and whatever that can support life, and it's finding them. Just this very day, there's a very big announcement going on, and it's looking very promising.
Well, mention that. I mean, this is a piece that you've written for NationalGeographic.com. The news that the Curiosity rover appears to have discovered the fossil remains of a lake not very far from where it first landed.
Right. Fascinating stuff. I mean, again, going back to Viking for a second, famously Carl Sagan and other great people in the field really thought that they were going to see living creatures in front of them, and there was great disappointment that they didn't. Then there was this backtracking, and maybe 15 years ago, the whole idea became follow the water, see where on Mars there was water, and that began very, very, with very small steps. But now you really hit the jackpot. Not only has there been a stream that has been clearly identified in Gale Crater, which is where the Curiosity rover is, but now the announcement that probably the stream, although it might have been some other source of water, had created a lake.
Yeah.
There's nothing better for kind of cooking up life than still water. And it turns out that this still water had the pH that's necessary for life to begin. They know from digging into a rock in this area and then analyzing some of its components, they know that the right kinds of minerals and chemicals are there. It is just fascinating stuff. This Curiosity is not capable of determining whether or not there's life, but man, they're really creating a storyline that says not only Gale Crater but a lot of other places on Mars had conditions where life could have evolved.
It's interesting. It makes me think about the potential for Mars if certain things hadn't happened, because the discovery kind of supports this idea that life could have survived on Mars for tens of millions of years, if I get that right, which isn't really that long if you compare it to the history of life on Earth. And somewhere down the line, Mars lost its magnetic field, we know, its atmosphere, and so it didn't have an ability to hold liquid water on its surface or protect it against solar radiation, and so things really changed. But it does make you wonder if it hadn't lost its magnetic field, what would have the potential have been for something more complicated in terms of life in Mars?
And I think the answer is that the possibility was probably great. People talk a lot now about early Mars as being warmer and wetter. And as a result, more conducive to the rise of life. And interestingly, it was warm and wet at roughly the same time that life began here.
Yeah.
And then you're correct, the atmosphere, the magnetic field seems to have pooped out, the atmosphere disappeared. But what they're finding is via Curiosity and then some of these remarkable orbiting satellites that go around Mars and are taking both images and getting other kind of spectrographic information, they're finding that there are lots and lots of places where it sure looks like there were rivers and streams and lakes. And there's even a theory that the whole northern part of the northern hemisphere of Mars was once a huge ocean. The possibility for life in that context is great. They're also finding via Curiosity that the period of time when conditions were warmer and wetter and potentially hospitable to life was probably much longer than they had initially thought. The Gale crater itself was created by a meteorite impact maybe 3.6 billion years ago, which is right at the cutoff edge of what was supposed to be the point where Mars just kind of, you know, went cold and dry and very acidic and, you know, became red because there was this rust iron oxide everywhere. But what they're finding in Gale Crater is very different. They're finding that habitable areas probably lasting hundreds of millions of years after that point. So fascinating story unfolding. You know, you're right that the understanding has long been that there was a relatively short window where there might have been life. Right. That is changing, as is the thinking about how life might conceivably still survive deep underground, just like in those gold mines in South Africa. Go down a couple miles and in subsurface Mars, and you might find the same kind of bacteria, just, you know, living a happy little life.
You know, it's interesting. You write about the fact that we have this understanding that the chemical building blocks for life, like carbon compounds, that they're ubiquitous throughout the universe. But there's always this sense that among some who believe that there was some sort of divine connection to all of this, that you needed some kind of spark to get things going. I'm wondering, what do we know about that? Because you mentioned Stanley Miller and Harold Urey, who did this experiment. But this was way back in 1952, that seemed to show that maybe you don't need some divine thing to get things started, that all the processes in nature can do that spark itself.
That would be the consensus view of scientists working in this field, that that the makings for life are there. You don't need a divine spark. Rather, like, you know, the whole question of astrobiology and not having a sample, the problem with origin of life science is no one has been able to reproduce it.
Right.
That is not to say that it isn't reproducible, but it hasn't been. And the people who were most deeply involved in it say that it is enormously complicated. And every time they feel that they've reached a point where they're making progress, they find that they're going back. And so scientists as a whole would be saying that life can be explained in purely natural terms rather than bringing in a divine force. But at the same time, they at this point don't have a scientific proof that says that.
Right. And of course, the question comes to, what will it mean for us that there is life out there? You mentioned in your book that, Copernicus and Galileo, they're the first ones that really told us, look, we're not at the center of the universe, but we didn't take that very well as human beings. So how is that going to change our impression of ourselves?
Boy, to me, this is really one of the grand questions. I think it's just a question of when life is found elsewhere. What will be the response here on Earth? And it's not like people are going to fall down and tear off their clothes and go crazy, but rather like Copernicus and Galileo, it will set into motion, I believe, a series of kind of intellectual community changes that will potentially have us understand our place in the galaxies and the universe very differently. I mean, human beings are wonderful, but I mean, we are such a minor, teeny tiny part of all that's out there. And if it turns out that there are other things like us out there, then we are probably less central. To me, that's a fascinating thing, and in an odd way, kind of a reassuring thing.
Yeah.
That we're part of this grand natural scheme that kind of operates on its own, and our place is not really that different than the place of what might be existing hundreds of light years away.
Yeah. You quote a French astrophysicist who says that the church, the Catholic Church in this case, shouldn't be indifferent to the fact that astrobiology could change the vision humanity has of itself. But you talk about how this idea may fit pretty well with some religions, some Eastern religions. You mention some modern Christian groups like Mormons. I mention that because there are a lot of Mormons around here, of course, and they have a very specific reference to extraterrestrial life. I mean, some evangelicals may not like it very well, you know, this idea, but I guess we'll adapt. Maybe we'll go back to evolution, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the issue for a lot of religious people would be is that evolution issue, because implicit in the idea of extraterrestrial life is that it could evolve and perhaps did evolve at different places. But you're absolutely right that there are that different religions, different world philosophies have looked at this in different ways and have come to different conclusions. But I will say this, that it's almost universal when you think about it, that human beings kind of look to the skies and want there to be something alive. I mean, think of it, angels. I mean, you know, where do people mostly put God? It's in Islam, there are jinns that are flying around ancient Chinese kind of thinking, there's the Jade Mountain that's up in the sky, and certainly in Buddhism and in Hinduism as well, there's a lot of life that's up there.
Mark Hoffman's book is First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. Joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Mark Hoffman, thank you very much for the time.
Well, you're quite welcome, and thank you for having me.
I should mention, we'll put a link to his article in nationalgeographic.com about Mars on our website. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.